The curtains and carpets were in royal blue. The waiters wore striped waistcoats and green baize aprons. Bond ordered an Americano and examined the sprinkling of overdressed customers, mostly from Paris, he guessed, who sat talking with focus and vivacity, creating that theatrically clubbable atmosphere of l'heure de l'apéritif. The men were drinking inexhaustible quarter bottles of champagne, the women dry martinis. "Moi, j'adore le dry," a bright-faced girl at the next table said to her companion, too neat in his unseasonable tweeds, who gazed at her with moist brown eyes over the top of an expensive shooting stick from Hermès. "Fait avec du Gordon's, bien entendu."
"D'accord, Daisy, mais tu sais, un zeste de citron."
Bond's eye was caught by the tall figure of Matisse on the pavement outside. His face turned in animation to a dark-haired girl in grey. His arm was linked in hers, high up above the elbow, and yet there was a lack of intimacy in their appearance, an ironical chill in the girl's profile, which made them seem two separate people rather than a couple. Bond waited for them to come through the street door into the bar, but for appearance's sake continued to stare out of the window at the passers-by.
"But surely it is Monsieur Bond!"
Matisse's voice behind him was full of surprised delight. Bond, appropriately flustered, rose to his feet.
"Can it be that you are alone? Are you awaiting someone? May I present my colleague, Mademoiselle Lynn? My dear, this is the gentleman from Jamaica with whom I had the pleasure of doing business this morning."
Bond inclined himself with a reserved friendliness.
"It would be a great pleasure." He addressed himself to the girl. "I am alone. Would you both care to join me?"
He pulled out a chair, and while they sat down he beckoned to a waiter, and despite Matisse's expostulations, insisted on ordering the drinks. A fine aloe for Matisse and a Bacardi for the girl. Matisse and Bond exchanged cheerful talk about the fine weather and the prospects of a revival in the fortunes of Royal Les Eaux. The girl sat silent. She accepted one of Bond's cigarettes, examined it, and then smoked it appreciatively and without affectation, drawing the smoke deeply into her lungs with a little sigh, and then exhaling it casually through her lips and nostrils. Her movements were economical and precise, with no trace of self-consciousness. Bond felt her presence strongly. While he and Matisse talked, he turned from time to time towards her, politely including her in the conversation, but adding up the impressions recorded by each glance. Her hair was very black, and she wore it cut square and low on the nape of the neck, framing her face to below the clear and beautiful line of her jaw. Although it was heavy and moved with the movements of her head, she did not constantly pat it back into place, but let it alone. Her eyes were wide apart and deep blue, and they gazed candidly back at Bond with a touch of ironical disinterest which, to his annoyance, he found he would like to shatter roughly. Her skin was lightly suntanned, and bore no trace of makeup except on her mouth, which was wide and sensual. Her bare arms and hands had a quality of repose, and the general impression of restraint in her appearance and movements was carried even to her fingernails, which were unpainted and cut short. Round her neck she wore a plain gold chain of wide flat links, and on the fourth finger of the right hand a broad topaz ring. Her medium-length dress was of grey soie sauvage, with a square-cut bodice, lasciviously tight across her fine breasts. The skirt was closely pleated and flowered down from a narrow but not a thin waist. She wore a 3-inch hand-stitched black belt. A hand-stitched black sabretache rested on the chair beside her, together with a wide cartwheel hat of gold straw, its crown encircled by a thin black velvet ribbon which tied at the back in a short bow. Her shoes were square-toed of plain black leather. Bond was excited by her beauty and intrigued by her composure. The prospect of working with her stimulated him. At the same time, he felt a vague disquiet. On an impulse, he touched wood. Matisse had noticed Bond's preoccupation. After a time, he rose.
"Forgive me," he said to the girl, "while I telephone to the Duberne. I must arrange my rendezvous for dinner tonight. Are you sure you won't mind being left to your own devices this evening?"
She shook her head. Bond took the cue, and as Matisse crossed the room to the telephone booth beside the bar, he said, "If you are going to be alone tonight,
Would you care to have dinner with me? She smiled with the first hint of conspiracy she had shown. I would like to very much, she said. And then perhaps you would chaperone me to the casino, where Monsieur Matisse tells me you are very much at home.
Perhaps I will bring you luck.
With Matisse gone, her attitude towards him showed a sudden warmth. She seemed to acknowledge that they were a team, and, as they discussed the time and place of their meeting, Bond realized that it would be quite easy, after all, to plan the details of his project with her. He felt that, after all, she was interested and excited by her role, and that she would work willingly with him. He had imagined many hurdles before establishing a rapport, but now he felt he could get straight down to professional details. He was quite honest to himself about the hypocrisy of his attitude towards her. As a woman, he wanted to sleep with her, but only when the job had been done. When Matisse came back to the table, Bond called for his bill. He explained that he was expected back at his hotel to have lunch with friends. When, for a moment, he held her hand in his, he felt a warmth of affection and understanding pass between them that would have seemed impossible half an hour earlier. The girl's eyes followed him out onto the boulevard. Matisse moved his chair close to hers and said softly,
"That is a very good friend of mine. I am glad you have met each other. I can already feel the ice floes on the two rivers breaking up," he smiled. "I don't think Bond has ever been melted. It will be a new experience for him. And for you."
She did not answer him directly.
"He is very good-looking. He reminds me rather of Hoagy Carmichael. But there is something cold and ruthless in his..."
The sentence was never finished. Suddenly, a few feet away, the entire plate-glass window shivered into confetti. The blast of a terrific explosion, very near, hit them so that they were rocked back in their chairs. There was an instant of silence. Some objects pattered down onto the pavement outside. Bottles slowly toppled off the shelves behind the bar. Then there were screams and a stampede for the door.
"Stay there," said Matisse.
He kicked back his chair and hurtled through the empty window frame onto the pavement.
Chapter 6. Two Men in Straw Hats. When Bond left the bar, he walked purposefully along the pavement flanking the tree-lined boulevard towards his hotel a few hundred yards away. He was hungry.
The day was still beautiful, but by now the sun was very hot, and the plane trees, spaced about 20 feet apart on the grass verge between the pavement and the broad tarmac, gave a cool shade. There were few people abroad, and the two men standing quietly under a tree on the opposite side of the boulevard looked out of place. Bond noticed them when he was still 100 yards away, and when the same distance separated them from the ornamental porte-cochère of the Splendide. There was something rather disquieting about their appearance. They were both small, and they were dressed alike in dark and, Bond reflected, rather hot-looking suits. They had the appearance of a variety turn waiting for a bus on the way to the theatre. Each wore a straw hat with a thick black ribbon as a concession, perhaps, to the holiday atmosphere of the resort, and the brims of these and the shadow from the tree under which they stood obscured their faces. Incongruously, each dark, squat little figure was illuminated by a touch of bright colour. They were both carrying square camera cases slung from the shoulder. And one case was bright red, and the other case bright blue. By the time Bond had taken in these details, he had come to within 50 yards of the two men. He was reflecting on the ranges of various types of weapon and the possibilities of cover when an extraordinary and terrible scene was enacted. Red Man seemed to give a short nod to Blue Man. With a quick movement, Blue Man unslung his blue camera case. Blue Man, and Bond could not see exactly as the trunk of a plane tree beside him just then intervened to obscure his vision, bent forward and seemed to fiddle with the case. Then, with a blinding flash of white light, there was the ear-splitting crack of a monstrous explosion, and Bond, despite the protection of the tree trunk, was slammed down to the pavement by a solid bolt of hot air which dented his cheeks and stomach as if they had been made of paper. He lay gazing up at the sun, while the air, or so it seemed to him, went on twanging with the explosion, as if someone had hit the bass register of a piano with a sledgehammer. When, dazed and half-conscious, he raised himself on one knee,
A ghastly rain of pieces of flesh and shreds of blood-soaked clothing fell on him and around him, mingled with branches and gravel. Then a shower of small twigs and leaves. From all sides came the sharp tinkle of falling glass. Above in the sky hung a mushroom of black smoke, which rose and dissolved as he drunkenly watched it. There was an obscene smell of high explosive, of burning wood, and of... yes, that was it. Roast mutton. For 50 yards down the boulevard, the trees were leafless and charred. Opposite, two of them had snapped off near the base and lay drunkenly across the road. Between them there was a still-smoking crater. Of the two men in straw hats, there remained absolutely nothing. But there were red traces on the road, and on the pavements, and against the trunks of the trees, and there were glittering shreds high up in the branches. Bond felt himself starting to vomit. It was Matisse who got to him first, and by that time Bond was standing with his arm round the tree which had saved his life. Stupefied but unharmed, he allowed Matisse to lead him off towards the Splendide, from which guests and servants were pouring in chattering fright. As the distant clang of bells heralded the arrival of ambulances and fire engines, they managed to push through the throng and up the short stairs and along the corridor to Bond's room. Matisse paused only to turn on the radio in front of the fireplace. Then, while Bond stripped off his blood-flecked clothes, Matisse sprayed him with questions. When it came to the description of the two men, Matisse tore the telephone off its hook beside Bond's bed.
"And tell the police," he concluded. "Tell them that the Englishman from Jamaica who was knocked over by the blast is my affair. He is unhurt, and they are not to worry him. I will explain to them in half an hour. They should tell the press that it was apparently a vendetta between two Bulgarian communists, and that one killed the other with a bomb. They need say nothing of the third Bulgar, who must have been hanging about somewhere, but they must get him at all costs. He will certainly head for Paris. Roadblocks everywhere. Understood? Alors, bonne chance."
Matisse turned back to Bond and heard him to the end.
"Merde, but you were lucky," he said when Bond had finished. "Clearly the bomb was intended for you. It must have been faulty. They intended to throw it and then dodge behind a tree, but it all came out the other way around. Never mind, we will discover the facts."
He paused.
"But certainly it is a curious affair, and these people appear to be taking you seriously."
Matisse looked affronted.
"But how did these sacré Bulgares intend to escape capture? And what was the significance of the red and the blue cases? We must try and find some fragments of the red one."
Matisse bit his nails. He was excited, and his eyes glittered. This was becoming a formidable and dramatic affair, in many aspects of which he was now involved personally. Certainly it was no longer just a case of holding Bond's coat while he had his private battle with Le Chiffre in the casino. Matisse jumped up.
"Now, get a drink and some lunch and a rest," he ordered Bond. "For me, I must get my nose quickly into this affair before the police have muddied the trail with their big black boots."
Matisse turned off the radio and waved an affectionate farewell. The door slammed, and silence settled on the room. Bond sat for a while by the window and enjoyed being alive. Later, as Bond was finishing his first straight whiskey on the rocks and was contemplating the pâté de foie gras and the cold langouste which the waiter had just laid out for him, the telephone rang.
"This is Mademoiselle Lind."
The voice was low and anxious.
"Are you all right?"
"Yes, quite."
"I'm glad. Please take care of yourself."
She rang off. Bond shook himself. Then he picked up his knife and selected the thickest of the pieces of hot toast. He suddenly thought, two of them are dead, and I've got one more on my side. It's a start. He dipped the knife into the glass of very hot water which stood beside the pot of Strasbourg porcelain, and reminded himself to tip the waiter doubly for this particular meal.
Chapter 7 Rouge et Noir.
Bond was determined to be completely fit and relaxed for a gambling session which might last most of the night. He ordered a masseur for 3 o'clock. After the remains of his luncheon had been removed, he sat at his window gazing out to sea until there came a knock on the door as the masseur, a Swede, presented himself. Silently he got to work on Bond from his feet to his neck,
melting the tensions in his body and calming his still twanging nerves. Even the long, purpling bruises down Bond's left shoulder and side ceased to throb, and when the Swede had gone, Bond fell into a dreamless sleep. He awoke in the evening completely refreshed. After a cold shower, Bond walked over to the casino. Since the night before he had lost the mood of the tables, he needed to re-establish that focus which is half mathematical and half intuitive, and which, with a slow pulse and a sanguine temperament, Bond knew to be the essential equipment of any gambler who was set on winning. Bond had always been a gambler. He loved the dry riffle of the cards and the constant, unemphatic drama of the quiet figures round the green tables. He liked the solid, studied comfort of card rooms and casinos, the well-padded arms of the chairs, the glass of champagne or whisky at the elbow, the quiet, unhurried attention of good servants. He was amused by the impartiality of the roulette ball and of the playing cards, and their eternal bias. He liked being an actor and a spectator, and from his chair to take part in other men's dramas and decisions, until it came to his own turn to say that vital yes or no, generally on a 50-50 chance. Above all, he liked it that everything was one's own fault. There was only oneself to praise or blame. Luck was a servant and not a master. Luck had to be accepted with a shrug or taken advantage of up to the hilt, but it had to be understood and recognised for what it was, and not confused with a faulty appreciation of the odds, for, at gambling, the deadly sin is to mistake bad play for bad luck. And luck, in all its moods, had to be loved and not feared. Bond saw luck as a woman, to be softly wooed or brutally ravaged, never pandered to or pursued. But he was honest enough to admit that he had never yet been made to suffer by cards or by women. One day, and he accepted the fact, he would be brought to his knees by love or by luck. When that happened, he knew that he too would be branded with the deadly question mark he recognised so often in others, the promise to pay before you have lost, the acceptance of fallibility. But on this June evening, when Bond walked through the kitchen into the salle privée, it was with a sense of confidence and cheerful anticipation that he changed 1,000,000 francs into plaque of 50 mi, and took a seat next to the chef de partie at roulette table number 1. Bond borrowed the chef's card and studied the run of the ball since the session had started at 3 o'clock that afternoon. He always did this, although he knew that each turn of the wheel, each fall of the ball into a numbered slot, has absolutely no connection with its predecessor. He accepted that the game begins afresh each time the croupier picks up the ivory ball with his right hand, gives one of the 4 spokes of the wheel a controlled twist clockwise with the same hand, and, with a 3rd motion, also with the right hand, flicks the ball round the outer rim of the wheel anti-clockwise, against the spin. It was obvious that all this ritual and all the mechanical minutiae of the wheel, of the numbered slots and the cylinder, had been devised and perfected over the years, so that neither the skill of the croupier nor any bias in the wheel could affect the fall of the ball. And yet it is a convention among roulette players, and Bond rigidly adhered to it, to take careful note of the past history of each session, and to be guided by any peculiarities in the run of the wheel. To note, for instance, and consider significant, sequences of more than 2 on a single number, or of more than 4 at the other chances down to evens. Bond didn't defend the practice. He simply maintained that the more effort and ingenuity you put into gambling, the more you took out. On the record of that particular table, after about 3 hours' play, Bond could see little of interest except that the last dozen had been out of favour. It was his practice to play always with the wheel and only to turn against its previous pattern and start on a new tack after a 0 had turned up. So he decided to play one of his favourite gambits and back 2, in this case the first 2, dozens each with the maximum, 100,000 francs. He thus had 2/3 of the board covered, less the 0, and since the dozens pay odds of 2 to 1, he stood to win 100,000 francs every time any number lower than 25 turned up. After 7 coups, he had won 6 times. He lost on the 7th when 30 came up. His net profit was 500,000 francs. He kept off the table for the eighth throw. Zero turned up. This piece of luck cheered him further, and, accepting the 30 as a fingerpost to the last dozen, he decided to back the first and last dozens until he had lost twice. 10 throws later, the middle dozen came up twice, costing him 400,000 francs, but he rose from the table 1,100,000 francs to the good. Directly Bond had started playing in maximums, his game had become the centre of interest at the table. As he seemed to be in luck, one or two pilot fish started to swim with the shark. Sitting directly opposite, one of these, whom Bond took to be an American, had shown more than the usual friendliness and pleasure at his share of the winning streak. He had smiled once or twice across the table, and there was something pointed in the way he duplicated Bond's movements, placing his two modest plaques of 10 mille exactly opposite Bond's larger ones. When Bond rose, he too pushed back his chair and called cheerfully across the table.
"Thanks for the ride. Guess I owe you a drink. Will you join me?"
Bond had a feeling that this might be the CIA man. He knew he was right as they strolled off together towards the bar, after Bond had thrown a plaque of 10 mille to the croupier and had given a mille to the huissier, who drew back his chair.
"My name's Felix Leiter," said the American. "Glad to meet you."
"Mine's Bond. James Bond."
"Oh, yes," said his companion. "Now, let's see. What shall we have to celebrate?"
Bond insisted on ordering Leiter's Hague & Hague on the rocks, and then he looked carefully at the barman. "A dry martini," he said. "One, in a deep champagne goblet."
"Oui, monsieur."
"Just a moment." 3 measures of Gordon's, 1 of vodka, 1/2 a measure of Quinault Lillet. Shake it very well until it's ice cold. Then add a large thin slice of lemon peel. Got it?"
"Certainly, monsieur."
The barman seemed pleased with the idea.
"Gosh, that's certainly a drink," said Leiter.
Bond laughed. "When I'm, concentrating," he explained. "I never have more than 1 drink before dinner. But I do like that 1 to be large and very strong and very cold and very well made. I hate small portions of anything, particularly when they taste bad. This drink's my own invention. I'm going to patent it when I can think of a good name." He watched carefully as the deep glass became frosted with the pale golden drink, slightly aerated by the bruising of the shaker. He reached for it and took a long sip. "Excellent," he said to the barman. "But if you can get a vodka made with grain instead of potatoes, you will find it still better."
"Mais non, qu'il n'en pas de mouche,"
he added in an aside to the barman. The barman grinned. "That's a vulgar way of saying we won't split hairs," explained Bond. But Leiter was still interested in Bond's drink.
"You certainly think things out," he said with amusement
as they carried their glasses to a corner of the room. He lowered his voice.
"You'd better call it the Molotov cocktail after the one you tasted this afternoon."
They sat down. Bond laughed.
"I see that the spot marked X has been roped off and they're making cars take a detour over the pavement. I hope it hasn't frightened away any of the big money." "People are accepting the communist story or else they think it was a burst gas main. All the burnt trees are coming down tonight, and if they work things here like they do at Monte Carlo, there won't be a trace of the mess left in the morning."
Leiter took a Chesterfield out of his pack.
"I'm glad to be working with you on this job," he said, looking into his drink. "So I'm particularly glad you didn't get blown to glory. Our people are definitely interested. They think it's just as important as your friends do, and they don't think there's anything crazy about it at all. In fact, Washington's pretty sick we're not running the show, but you know what the big brass is like. I expect your fellas are much the same in London."
Bond nodded. "Apt to be a bit jealous of their scoops," he admitted.
"Anyway, I'm under your orders, and I'm to give you any help you ask for. With Matisse and his boys here, there may not be much that isn't taken care of already. But anyway, here I am."
"I'm delighted you are," said Bond. "The opposition has got me, and probably you and Matisse too, all weighed up, and it seems no holds are going to be barred. I'm glad Le Chiffre seems as desperate as we thought he was. I'm afraid I hadn't got anything very specific for you to do, but I'd be grateful if you'd stick around the casino this evening. I've got an assistant, a Miss Lind, and I'd like to hand her over to you when I start playing. You won't be ashamed of her. She's a good-looking girl. He smiled at Leiter. And you might mark his two gunmen. I can't imagine he'll try a roughhouse, but you never know.
I may be able to help, said Leiter. I was a regular in our Marine Corps before I joined this racket, if that means anything to you.
He looked at Bond with a hint of self-deprecation.
It does, said Bond. It turned out that Leiter was from Texas. While he talked on about his job with the Joint Intelligence Staff of NATO and the difficulty of maintaining security in an organization where so many nationalities were represented, Bond reflected that good Americans were fine people and that most of them seemed to come from Texas. Felix Leiter was about 35. He was tall with a thin, bony frame, and his lightweight, tan-coloured suit hung loosely from his shoulders like the clothes of Frank Sinatra. His movements and speech were slow, but one had the feeling that there was plenty of speed and strength in him, and that he would be a tough and cruel fighter. As he sat hunched over the table, he seemed to have some of the jackknife quality of a falcon. There was this impression also in his face, in the sharpness of his chin and cheekbones and the wide, wry mouth. His grey eyes had a feline slant, which was increased by his habit of screwing them up against the smoke of the Chesterfields, which he tapped out of the pack in a chain.
The permanent wrinkles which this habit had etched at the corners gave the impression that he smiled more with his eyes than with his mouth. A mop of straw-coloured hair lent his face a boyish look, which closer examination contradicted.
Although he seemed to talk quite openly about his duties in Paris, Bond soon noticed that he never spoke of his American colleagues in Europe or in Washington, and he guessed that Leiter held the interests of his own organization far above the mutual concerns of the North Atlantic allies. Bond sympathized with him. By the time Leiter had swallowed another whiskey and Bond had told him about the Muntzes and his short reconnaissance trip down the coast that morning, it was 7:30, and they decided to stroll over to their hotel together. Before leaving the casino, Bond deposited his total capital of $24 million at the case, keeping only a few notes of 10 mi as pocket money. As they walked across to the Splendide, they saw that a team of workmen was already busy at the scene of the explosion. Several trees were uprooted and hoses from three municipal tank cars were washing down the boulevard and pavements. The bomb crater had disappeared, and only a few passers-by had paused to gape. Bond assumed that similar facelifting had already been carried out at the Hermitage and to the shops and frontages which had lost their windows. In the warm blue dusk, Royal Les Eaux was once again orderly and peaceful.
"Who's the concierge working for?"
asked Leiter as they approached the hotel. Bond was not sure and said so. Matisse had been unable to enlighten him.
"Unless you have bought him yourself," he had said, "you must assume that he has been bought by the other side. All concierge are venal. It is not their fault. They are trained to regard all hotel guests except Maharajas as potential cheats and thieves. They have as much concern for your comfort or well-being as crocodiles."
Bond remembered Matisse's pronouncement when the concierge hurried up to inquire whether he had recovered from his most unfortunate experience of the afternoon. Bond thought it well to say that he still felt a little shaky. He hoped that if the intelligence were relayed, Le Chiffre would at any rate start playing that evening with a basic misinterpretation of his adversary's strength. The concierge proffered glycerine hopes for Bond's recovery. Leiter's room was on one of the upper floors, and they parted company at the lift after arranging to see each other at the casino at around 10:30 or 11, the usual hour for the high tables to begin play. Chapter 8. Pink Lights and Champagne. Bond walked up to his room, which again showed no sign of trespass, threw off his clothes, took a long, hot bath followed by an ice-cold shower, and lay down on his bed. There remained an hour in which to rest and compose his thoughts before he met the girl in the Splendide bar, an hour to examine minutely the details of his plans for the game, and for after the game, in all the various circumstances of victory or defeat. He had to plan the attendant roles of Matisse, Leiter, and the girl, and visualize the reactions of the enemy in various contingencies. He closed his eyes, and his thoughts pursued his imagination through a series of carefully constructed scenes, as if he was watching the tumbling chips of coloured glass in a kaleidoscope. At 9:20, he had exhausted all the permutations which might result from his duel with Le Chiffre. He rose and dressed, dismissing the future completely from his mind. As he tied his thin, double-ended black satin tie, he paused for a moment and examined himself levelly in the mirror. His grey-blue eyes looked calmly back with a hint of ironical inquiry, and the short lock of black hair, which would never stay in place, slowly subsided to form a thick comma above his right eyebrow. With the thin vertical scar down his right cheek, the general effect was faintly piratical. Not much of Hoagie Carmichael there, thought Bond, as he filled a flat, light gunmetal box with 50 of the Morland cigarettes with the triple gold band. Matisse had told him of the girl's comment. He slipped the case into his hip pocket and snapped his black oxidized Ronson to see if it needed fuel. After pocketing the thin sheaf of 10-meal notes, he opened a drawer and took out a light chamois leather holster and slipped it over his left shoulder so that it hung about 3 inches below his armpit. He then took from under his shirts in another drawer a very flat .25 Beretta automatic with a skeleton grip, extracted the clip and the single round in the barrel, and whipped the action to and fro several times, finally pulling the trigger on the empty chamber. He charged the weapon again, loaded it, put up the safety catch and dropped it into the shallow pouch of the shoulder holster. He looked carefully round the room to see if anything had been forgotten, and slipped his single-breasted dinner jacket coat over his heavy silk evening shirt. He felt cool and comfortable. He verified in the mirror that there was absolutely no sign of the flat gun under his left arm, gave a final pull at his narrow tie, and walked out of the door and locked it. When he turned at the foot of the short stairs towards the bar, he heard the lift door open behind him and a cool voice call, "Good evening." It was the girl. She stood and waited for him to come up to her. He had remembered her beauty exactly. He was not surprised to be thrilled by it again. Her dress was of black velvet, simple and yet with a touch of splendour that only half a dozen couturiers in the world can achieve. There was a thin necklace of diamonds at her throat and a diamond clip in the low V which just exposed the jutting swell of her breasts. She carried a plain black evening bag, a flat oblong which she now held her arm akimbo at her waist. Her jet-black hair hung straight and simply to the final inward curl below the chin. She looked quite superb, and Bond's heart lifted. "You look absolutely lovely. Business must be good in the radio world." She put her arm through his. "Do you mind if we go straight into dinner?" she asked. "I want to make a grand entrance, and the truth is, there's a horrible secret about black velvet. It marks when you sit down, and, by the way, if you hear me scream tonight, I shall have sat on a cane chair." Bond laughed. "Of course. Let's go straight in. We'll have a glass of vodka while we order our dinner." She gave him an amused glance, and he corrected himself. "Or a cocktail, of course, if you prefer it. The food here is the best in Royale." For an instant he felt nettled at the irony, the light shadow of a snub with which she had met his decisiveness, and at the way he had risen to her quick glance. But it was only an infinitesimal clink of foils, and as the bowing maitre d'hôtel led them through the crowded room, it was forgotten as Bond, in her wake, watched the heads of the diners turn to look at her. The fashionable part of the restaurant was beside the wide crescent of window built out like the broad stern of a ship over the hotel gardens, but Bond had chosen a table in one of the mirrored alcoves at the back of the great room. These had survived from Edwardian days, and they were secluded and gay in white and gilt, with the red silk-shaded table and wall lights of the late Empire. As they deciphered the maze of purple ink which covered the double-folio menu, Bond beckoned to the sommelier. He turned to his companion. "Have you decided?" "I would love a glass of vodka," she said simply, and went back to her study of the menu.
"A small carafe of vodka, very cold," ordered Bond. He said to her abruptly, "I can't drink the health of your new frock without knowing your Christian name."
"Vesper," she said. "Vesper Lind." Bond gave her a look of inquiry. "It's rather a bore always having to explain, but I was born in the evening, on a very stormy evening, according to my parents. Apparently they wanted to remember it. She smiled. Some people like it, others don't. I'm just used to it.
I think it's a fine name, said Bond.
An idea struck him. Can I borrow it? He explained about the special martini he had invented and his search for a name for it. The Vesper, he said. It sounds perfect, and it's very appropriate to the violet hour when my cocktail will now be drunk all over the world. Can I have it?
So long as I can try one first, she promised. It sounds a drink to be proud of.
We'll have one together when all this is finished, said Bond. Win or lose. And now, have you decided what you would like to have for dinner? Please, be expensive, he added as he sensed her hesitation, or you'll let down that beautiful frock.
I'd made two choices, she laughed, and either would have been delicious, but behaving like a millionaire occasionally is a wonderful treat. And if you're sure... Well, I'd like to start with caviar, and then have a plain grilled rognon de veau with pomme soufflé, and then I'd like to have fraise de bois with a lot of cream. Is it very shameless to be so certain and so expensive?
She smiled at him inquiringly.
It's a virtue. And anyway, it's only a good, plain, wholesome meal.
He turned to the maitre d'hôtel. And bring plenty of toast.
The trouble always is, he explained to Vesper, not how to get enough caviar, but how to get enough toast with it.
Now, he turned back to the menu. I myself will accompany Mademoiselle with the caviar, but then I would like a very small tourne d'eau underdone with sauce béarnaise and a cœur d'artichaut. While Mademoiselle is enjoying the strawberries, I will have half an avocado pear with a little French dressing. Do you approve?
The maitre d'hôtel bowed.
My compliments, Mademoiselle and Monsieur.
Monsieur Georges!
He turned to the sommelier and repeated the two dinners for his benefit.
Parfait, said the sommelier, proffering the leather-bound wine list.
If you agree, said Bond, I would prefer to drink champagne with you tonight. It is a cheerful wine, and it suits the occasion, I hope, he added.
Yes, I would like champagne, she said.
With his finger on the page, Bond turned to the sommelier.
The Tattinger 45?
A fine wine, monsieur, said the sommelier. But if monsieur will permit...
He pointed with his pencil.
The Blanc de Blanc Brut 1943 of the same mark is without equal.
Bond smiled.
So be it, he said.
That is not a well-known brand, Bond explained to his companion, but it is probably the finest champagne in the world. He grinned suddenly at the touch of pretension in his remark.
You must forgive me, he said. I take a ridiculous pleasure in what I eat and drink. It comes partly from being a bachelor, but mostly from a habit of taking a lot of trouble over details. It's very pernickety and old maidish, really. But then, when I'm working, I generally have to eat my meals alone, and it makes them more interesting when one takes trouble.
Vesper smiled at him.
I like it, she said. I like doing everything fully, getting the most out of everything one does. I think that's the way to live.
But it sounds rather schoolgirlish when one says it, she added apologetically. The little carafe of vodka had arrived in its bowl of crushed ice, and Bond filled their glasses.
Well, I agree with you anyway, he said. And now, here's luck for tonight, Vesper.
Yes,
said the girl quietly, as she held up her small glass and looked at him with a curious directness straight in the eyes.
I hope all will go well tonight.
She seemed to Bond to give a quick, involuntary shrug of the shoulders as she spoke, but then she leant impulsively towards him.
I have some news for you from Matisse. He was longing to tell you himself. It's about the bomb. It's a fantastic story.
Chapter 9. The Game is Baccarat. Bond looked round, but there was no possibility of being overheard, and the caviar would be waiting for the hot toast from the kitchens.
Tell me.
His eyes glittered with interest.
They got the third Bulgar on the road to Paris. He was in a Citroën, and he had picked up two English hikers as protective colouring. At the roadblock, his French was so bad that they asked for his papers, and he brought out a gun and shot one of the motorcycle patrol. But the other man got him, I don't know how,
and managed to stop him committing suicide. Then they took him down to Rouen and extracted the story, in the usual French fashion, I suppose. Apparently they were part of a pool held in France for this sort of job, saboteurs, thugs, and so on, and Matisse's friends are already trying to round up the rest. They were to get 2 million francs for killing you, and the agent who briefed them told them there was absolutely no chance of being caught if they followed his instructions exactly. She took a sip of vodka. But this is the interesting part. The agent gave them the 2 camera cases you saw. He said the bright colours would make it easier for them. He told them that the blue case contained a very powerful smoke bomb. The red case was the explosive. As one of them threw the red case, the other was to press a switch on the blue case, and they would escape under cover of the smoke. In fact, the smoke bomb was a pure invention to make the Bulgars think they could get away. Both cases contained an identical high-explosive bomb. There was no difference between the blue and the red cases. The idea was to destroy you and the bomb throwers without trace. Presumably there were other plans for dealing with the third man. "Go on," said Bond, full of admiration for the ingenuity of the double cross. Well, apparently, the Bulgars thought this sounded very fine, but cannily they decided to take no chances. It would be better, they thought, to touch off the smoke bomb first and from inside the cloud of smoke hurl the explosive bomb at you. What you saw was the assistant bomb thrower pressing down the lever on the phony smoke bomb, and, of course, they both went up together. The third Bulgar was waiting behind the Splendide to pick his 2 friends up. When he saw what had happened, he assumed they had bungled. But the police picked up some fragments of the unexploded red bomb, and he was confronted with them. When he saw that they had been tricked, and that his 2 friends were meant to be murdered with you, he started to talk. I expect he's still talking now. But there's nothing to link all this with Le Chiffre. They were given the job by some intermediary, perhaps one of Le Chiffre's guards, and Le Chiffre's name means absolutely nothing to the one who survived. She finished her story just as the waiters arrived with the caviar, a mound of hot toast and small dishes containing finely chopped onion and grated hard-boiled egg, the white in one dish and the yolk in another. The caviar was heaped onto their plates, and they ate for a time in silence.
After a while, Bond said, "It's very satisfactory to be a corpse who changes places with his murderers. For them, it certainly was a case of being hoist with their own petard.
Matisse must be very pleased with the day's work. 5 of the opposition neutralised in 24 hours. And he told her how the Munces had been confounded. "Incidentally," he asked, "how did you come to get mixed up in this affair? What section are you in?"
"I'm personal assistant to Head of S," said Vesper. "As it was his plan, he wanted his section to have a hand in the operation, and he asked M if I could go. It seemed only to be a liaison job, so M said yes, although he told my chief that you would be furious at being given a woman to work with." She paused, and when Bond said nothing, continued, "I had to meet Matisse in Paris and come down with him. I've got a friend who is a vendeuse with Dior, and somehow she managed to borrow me this, and the frock I was wearing this morning. Otherwise I couldn't possibly have competed with all these people." She made a gesture towards the room. The office was very jealous, although they didn't know what the job was. All they knew was that I was to work with a double O. Of course, you're our heroes. I was enchanted. Bond frowned. "It's not difficult to get a double O number if you're prepared to kill people," he said. "That's all the meaning it has. It's nothing to be particularly proud of. I've got the corpses of a Japanese cipher expert in New York and a Norwegian double agent in Stockholm to thank for being a double O. Probably quite decent people. They just got caught up in the gale of the world like that Yugoslav that Tito bumped off. It's a confusing business, but if it's one's profession, one does what one's told. How do you like the grated egg with your caviar?" "It's a wonderful combination," she said. "I'm loving my dinner. It seems a shame."
She stopped, warned by a cold look in Bond's eye. "If it wasn't for the job, we wouldn't be here," he said. Suddenly he regretted the intimacy of their dinner and of their talk. He felt he had said too much, and that what was only a working relationship had become confused. "Let's consider what has to be done," he said in a matter-of-fact voice. "I'd better explain what I'm going to try and do, and how you can help, which isn't very much, I'm afraid," he added. "Now, these are the basic facts." He proceeded to sketch out the plan and enumerate the various contingencies which faced them.
The maitre d'hotel supervised the serving of the second course, and then, as they ate the delicious food, Bond continued. She listened to him coldly, but with attentive obedience. She felt thoroughly deflated by his harshness, while admitting to herself that she should have paid more heed to the warning of Head of S. "He's a dedicated man," her chief had said when he gave her the assignment. "Don't imagine this is going to be any fun. He thinks of nothing but the job on hand, and while it's on, he's absolute hell to work for. But he's an expert, and there aren't many about, so you won't be wasting your time. He's a good-looking chap, but don't fall for him. I don't think he's got much heart. Anyway, good luck, and don't get hurt." All this had been something of a challenge, and she was pleased when she felt she attracted and interested him, as she knew intuitively that she did. Then, at a hint that they were finding pleasure together, a hint that was only the first words of a conventional phrase, he had suddenly turned to ice and had brutally veered away as if warmth were poison to him. She felt hurt and foolish. Then she gave a mental shrug and concentrated with all her attention on what he was saying. She would not make the same mistake again. "And the main hope is to pray for a run of luck for me, or against him." Bond was explaining just how baccarat is played. "It's much the same as any other gambling game. The odds against the banker and the player are more or less even. Only a run against either can be decisive and break the bank, or break the players. Tonight, Le Chiffre, we know, has bought the baccarat bank from the Egyptian syndicate which is running the high tables here. He paid 1 million francs for it, and his capital has been reduced to 24 million. I have about the same. There will be 10 players, I expect, and we sit round the banker at a kidney-shaped table. Generally, this table is divided into 2 tableaux. The banker plays 2 games, one against each of the tableaux to left and right of him. In that game, the banker should be able to win by playing off 1 tableau against the other and by first-class accountancy. But there aren't enough baccarat players yet at Royale, and Le Chiffre is just going to pit his luck against the other players at the single tableau. It's unusual, because the odds in favour of the banker aren't so good, but there is shade in his favour, and, of course, he has control of the size of the stakes. Well, the banker sits there in the middle, with a croupier to rake in the cards and call the amount of each bank, and a chef de partie to umpire the game generally. I shall be sitting as near dead opposite Le Chiffre as I can get. In front of him he has a shoe containing 6 packs of cards, well shuffled. There's absolutely no chance of tampering with the shoe. The cards are shuffled by the croupier and cut by one of the players and put into the shoe in full view of the table. We've checked on the staff and they're all okay. It would be useful but almost impossible to mark all the cards, and it would mean the connivance at least of the croupier. Anyway, we shall be watching for that too. Bond drank some champagne and continued. Now what happens at the game is this. The banker announces an opening bank of 500,000 francs, or £500 as it is now. Each seat is numbered from the right of the banker, and the player next to the banker, or number 1, can accept this bet and push his money out onto the table, or pass it if it is too much for him, or he doesn't want to take it. Then number 2 has the right to take it, and if he refuses, then number 3, and so on round the table. If no single player takes it at all, the bet is offered to the table as a whole, and everyone chips in, including sometimes the spectators round the table, until the 500,000 is made up. That is a small bet, which would immediately be met, but when it gets to 1 million or 2, it's often difficult to find a taker, or even, if the bank seems to be in luck, a group of takers to cover the bet. At that moment, I shall always try and step in and accept the bet. In fact, I shall attack Le Chiffre's bank whenever I get a chance, until either I've bust his bank or he's bust me. It may take some time, but in the end one of us is bound to break the other, irrespective of the other players at the table, although they can, of course, make him richer or poorer in the meantime. Being the banker, he's got a slight advantage in the play, but knowing that I'm making a dead set at him, and not knowing, I hope, my capital, is bound to play on his nerves a bit, so I'm hoping that we start about equal. He paused while the strawberries came and the avocado pear. For a while they ate in silence. Then they talked of other things while the coffee was served. They smoked. Neither of them drank brandy or a liqueur. Finally, Bond felt it was time to explain the actual mechanics of the game. "It's a simple affair," he said.
And you'll understand it at once if you've ever played 21, where the object is to get cards from the banker which add up more closely to a count of 21 than his do. In this game, I get two cards, and the banker gets two. And unless anyone wins outright, either or both of us can get one more card. The object of the game is to hold two or three cards, which together count 9 points, or as nearly nine as possible. Court cards and tens count nothing, aces one each, any other card its face value. It is only the last figure of your count that signifies, so 9 plus 7 equals 6, not 16. The winner